Welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly roundup of what's been happening in Ukraine, focusing on a main story. I'm Marco Suprin for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv, and here's a look at some of the stories that were in the news this week. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko congratulated Donald Trump on winning the U.S. election. Poroshenko met with the U.S. ambassador in Kyiv, Marie Yovanovitch, and invited the president-elect to visit Ukraine. He also expressed gratitude that the sanctions against Russia would be continued in December, and the new U.S. administration would remain a reliable partner in the struggle for democracy. President Vladimir Putin, on the other hand, sent President-elect Donald Trump a telegram. That's right, in the age of electronic communication, apparently the telegram trumps Twitter in Moscow. Later in the show, we'll be talking about what changes, if any, will a President Trump bring to American foreign policy with Ukraine. This week, Ukraine's parliament adopted several laws that are expected to promote Ukraine's economy. First of all, the parliament voted to limit state inspections of businesses to one inspection every 2 years for businesses categorized as high risk, one inspection every 3 years for medium-sized businesses, and one inspection every 5 years for all other businesses. This is supposed to increase business efficiency by saving time and money that used to be wasted by responding to what the business community has called excessive governmental queries. Ukraine was recently ranked by the World Bank's Doing Business metric with an 80, improving its position by 4 points compared to the last year. Is that good or bad, you might be wondering? Well, the same metric ranks the United States an 8, Canada gets a 22, Poland got 24, and Russia was ranked 40. A score of 1 equals the most business-friendly regulations. We'll include a link to the World Bank on our page. The parliament also adopted a law facilitating the export of freelance services, and it's expected to be pretty good for Ukraine's IT industry. Cross-border contracts can now be signed digitally, and Ukrainian banks will not request translation of documents from English to Ukrainian for financial monitoring purposes anymore. The authors of the law estimated the annual value of exported services by freelancers at $350 million U.S. dollars. Another development aimed at promoting Ukrainian export is an educational project for businessmen called How to Enter EU Markets, which was announced by a website called Education Era. This online course explains how to find international partners, conduct market research, how to meet European standards of quality, and is available for a preliminary subscription right now. Time will tell if these developments will help to improve the economic situation in Ukraine. Meanwhile, Ukraine's government has adopted a new list of recommended goods and services, which is supposed to help determine the minimum cost of living in the country. The list, or the basket of goods, has not been updated for over 15 years. The newly amended list recommends Ukrainians should consume more meat, cereals, and fruits. Apparently, Ukrainians should have 145 grams of meat per day, and that comes to about 53 kilograms per year, and 19 grams of fish. However, the consumer goods list still appears a little outdated. For example, it assumes that a person will use just one pillow for 15 years and will not need the internet or a mobile phone. Finally, the minimum wage is expected to be increased to an equivalent of around $124 US per month in 2017. Medications used to treat cardiovascular diseases, type 2 diabetes, and bronchial asthma might become, on average, 2 times less expensive than it is now for Ukrainians starting on January 1st as a result of the government's effort to reform healthcare in Ukraine. The government plans to fix what they believe are quote-unquote fair prices for such drugs and medications and start reimbursing the full price of these drugs beginning in April of 2017. Prime Minister Volodymyr Groysman explained on his Facebook page that the prices for medications in Ukraine have been significantly higher than in neighboring countries because of monopolies on the pharmaceutical market, and this kind of referencing in prices will make medications less expensive for your average Ukrainian. Another important health-related social development is that Ukraine is about to establish inclusive education for children with physical or mental health problems. Ukraine's First Lady Marina Poroshenko has secured $200,000 of funding from the Silk Road Chamber of International Commerce in China. Mrs. Poroshenko said that only 10% of over 700,000 children with special needs are currently studying in inclusive schools, whereas the rest are either homeschooled or lived in specialized boarding schools, which can often negatively impact a child's full social adaptation. The Chinese grant is supposed to contribute to the development of a roadmap for an inclusive educational system in Ukraine. A few weeks ago, Ukraine's government adopted a decision that requires regular schools to provide inclusive classes for children with special needs starting next September. Children with special needs will study at a special preparatory classes at first and will then be transferred to inclusive classes in regular schools, which will supposedly allow for better socialization. Hromadske Radio reported that former president of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili, resigned from his post as the head of the Odessa region this week. Mikhail Saakashvili threw in his towel, claiming that he can't continue working with Ukraine's authorities whose, quote, sole motivation is to rob Ukraine. Nevertheless, Saakashvili promised to continue the fight against corruption in Ukraine after his resignation, which has yet to be signed by President Poroshenko. Is a visa-free regime a reality? Well, Ukrainians can now travel to Albania without a visa. This apparently might be the start of something big. The Minister of Foreign Affairs of Belgium, Didier Reynders, has reconfirmed this week that Ukraine has satisfied all of the requirements for visa-free regime with Europe that we talked about last week and claimed that Belgium is ready to support visa-free travel for Ukrainians. We'll keep an eye on that story as it develops. A volunteer effort called Airborne Reconnaissance has documented the movement of Russian proxy forces' weapons in the occupied territories of Luhansk. Their drones have shown the location of 152mm caliber weapons, transport vehicles, and other machinery. They work together with the Information Resistance Group and make regular posts of their findings online. We'll include a link to their site so you can see the evidence for yourselves. The Russian occupation army and their proxies continue using large caliber artillery and other heavy weapons prohibited by the Minsk Agreement. Since November 4th, the press center of the anti-terrorist operation reported anywhere between 20 to 100 cases of ceasefire violations daily. One civilian was killed and three were wounded this week, according to the Union Press Agency. Three Ukrainian soldiers were killed around Mariupol, Avdiivka, and Marianka, and 18 more were wounded this week. The Information Resistance Group also reported the death of a Navy soldier near Mariupol on November 9th. However, this information has not yet been officially confirmed by the ATO press center. The Mariupol line of contact was the most dangerous this week, although fighting continues to escalate near the town of Stanitsa Luhanska, as well as in the Donetsk region in the towns of Toretsk, Marianka, and Avdiivka. In an interview with Hromadske Radio, the co-founder of a non-governmental organization called Prava Sprava, or Right Deeds, Dmytro Sniheryov, said the Russian proxy administration in Luhansk continues to use children in military operations as sappers. That is, kids are being exploited to build and repair roads, bridges, and clearing mines. After this evidence was presented at the negotiations in Minsk and got some media coverage, the Russian proxy administration in Luhansk apparently received instructions from their supervisors to similarly arrest children who might seem to be participating in military activities that help the Ukrainian side. Since Ukraine does not engage children in military activities, Russian proxies have chosen to arrest teenage football fans of the Luhansk football club Zorya, known for their pro-Ukrainian views, and took them into custody because of subversive activities. Sniheryov predicts that we'll have another sham trial, after which the football fans will publicly be given mercy and released. We'll include a link to the story on our page. The U.S. elections are over, and the American electorate have spoken. The world now has a president-elect, Donald Trump. When the results were coming in and things were turning in Trump's favor, apparently Canada's immigration website crashed. Some people are comparing the vote to the referendum in the UK that gave the world Brexit. What does the election of Donald Trump mean for Ukraine? Well, to hopefully build an answer to that question, we have three guests in the studio with us. Katie Ward has been engaged in international economic and business development. Before moving to Ukraine, Katie worked throughout Canada and internationally as a business consultant. She is an award-winning multimedia producer and economic developer who has created and activated several international campaigns aimed at attracting foreign direct investment and trade. Currently, Katie is a senior governance advisor for the Federation of Canadian Municipalities International Program Partnership for Local Economic Development and Democratic Governance. She works with 16 cities across Ukraine to support open governance, economic development, and intergovernmental cooperation. Brian Mefford is a business and political consultant based in Kyiv and has worked in Eastern Europe for more than 17 years. The Kyiv Post named him as one of the 20 most influential expats in Ukraine. He was resident program officer of the International Republican Institute for over a decade in Ukraine and then went on to consult thousands of political activists and government officials in Ukraine, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Moldova, and other countries. He then established the Committee for Open Democracy, a nonprofit organization that has observed more than 30 elections in 9 countries. And finally, our third guest is Michael Butsirkiu, a longtime Canadian journalist, public relations officer, and Ukraine expert. As a journalist, he worked in North America, Asia, and Europe. He was a communications consultant for the United Nations, UNICEF, and the World Health Organization. Most recently, he was the spokesman for the OSCE Special Monitoring Mission during Russia's war against Ukraine from 2014 through, I think, the end of 2015. He was one of the first neutrals, they called them, that got access to the crash site of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 back in 2014. And he's one of the few people to have been inside the occupied city of Donetsk and has witnessed firsthand and up close what's been accepted as Russia's hybrid war against Ukraine. Katie, Brian, Michael, thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Good to be here.
Brian, let me start with you. I know it's too early to tell, but based on your experience, will Trump be able to change U.S. foreign policy toward Ukraine? And should our show begin with the theme, the Darth Vader theme from Star Wars?
Well, certainly during the campaign, Donald Trump's statements about Ukraine gave the Ukrainian government, Ukrainian people, ample reason for alarm. This was a turn of events from the current administration's policy towards Ukraine, which has been perhaps a little slow in the beginning of the early days of Euromaidan, but since that time has been quite supportive in pushing and quite critical in pushing for reforms. How will that affect U.S. policy towards Ukraine? That remains to be seen. There's three factors to take into consideration. Number one, as we all know, candidates say things on the campaign trail, and they do different things in office. Now, will that be the case with Trump? Only Trump knows. So we'll have to see. Was that just merely rhetoric? I can get along with Putin. I can get along with everybody. Sometimes you do see candidates say things like that. Nixon said he had a secret plan to end the war in Vietnam. So at times candidates say things that later are changed. Number two, the other thing to consider is the fact that the State Department and the Department of Defense, as well as the intelligence agencies, they're an ongoing organic part of the government, and they're functioning, and they don't make plans month to month or week to week. They make plans over 5, 10 year, 20 year periods towards different countries, particularly Ukraine. If you look at the Bill Clinton to George W. Bush to Barack Obama administrations, the major policies towards Ukraine have not changed that much. So we'll see if the State Department, Defense Department, and intelligence agencies have a way of, say, moderating Trump's agenda with regard to Ukraine.
Katie, when Trudeau became Prime Minister in Canada, we saw almost, very quickly in any event, the signing of a free trade agreement. Do you think that kind of quick move is possible with the Trump administration?
You know, it's an interesting question for Canada because U.S. is Canada's largest trading partner, and it's very important for our economy. But with that said, we've been trying to diversify because that's an important part of our strategy. So the free trade agreement is important to Canada with Ukraine as part of that diversification strategy. And I think that we're not going to lose that as a priority as a trade partner. We have a huge diaspora, 10 members of parliament from Ukrainian heritage. So Ukraine continues to be on the radar. What is interesting right now happening in Canada is a review of what we call the countries of focus for our development work. So right now, Canada has a significant amount of development projects here, ranging from supporting police reform, education reform, decentralization reform, local economic development. Is being reviewed right now by the Trudeau government. It was something he came in and said, let's look at our development strategy and review the countries of focus. So we're all waiting to see what the Trudeau government will continue as a focus. And so this is a bigger question, I think, for Ukraine.
Okay, well, I mean, government moves slowly. That's understood. But Michael, as a former person who worked inside international organizations, does a change in foreign policy of the United States, I mean, let's face it, that's one of the major players, does it throw a wrench into the internal dynamics, the work that happens on the inside, or is it simply a pebble in the road? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think Brian set it up very well when he, you know, suggested that even though you may have changes of faces at the top, you know, bureaucracies continue to work, diplomats continue to work, that sort of thing. Of course, right now what we're seeing among diplomats working on bringing peace to Ukraine is immense frustration. Almost every diplomatic lever has been pulled, I think, and after many months of trying, the Minsk Accords still are not working the way they're supposed to. We still have daily violations of the ceasefire, sometimes in hundreds of explosions. We haven't had the pullback of heavy weaponry, pullback of troops, that sort of thing. Now, having said all that, I think that what we may see is one of the first hallmarks of Trump foreign policy is a kind of reset of relations with Moscow and with Putin. He's many times indicated that he'd like to do business with the Kremlin and to really change the way things are. So I think it's really important for a country like Ukraine to get their people in there early, to start giving them policy suggestions. And I would say also that we have very good diaspora organizations. For example, the U.S.-Ukraine Foundation has been around for about two decades in Washington, extremely well connected. So they're well placed to help influence things. I'll also add that that, you know, in terms of Ukraine and U.S. relations, they'll probably be looking for two main things. And one of that is, of course, the continued support for sanctions. I'm not so sure a Trump administration would be so supportive of them. And then secondly, the continued defense cooperation. And Ukraine is still waiting to see whether the U.S. will supply lethal weaponry to make a huge difference in the field. So many things to look out for. But I like to think optimistically that relations will remain on a very good level between Ukraine and the U.S. But again, I can't overemphasize how important it is for Ukraine to get in there now on the ground level. One more quick thing, if I can. Newt Gingrich, who is possibly going to be the next Secretary of State, he was in Ukraine about a month and a half ago here for the YES conference. And I know he had many good meetings and briefings, and I had a few words with him. And it seems that he came away with a very good understanding of the conflict in the East. So there could be some positives from there too.
Brian, do you think that President Poroshenko and Prime Minister Groysman will have to change their tactic? Michael brings up a good point that they need to get somebody on the ground working with diaspora organizations. Do you think that they have a clear idea or a clear plan ahead of them to work with a GOP majority?
One of the things that I've criticized the government for in my blog that I write is the fact that, you know, the Russians are very serious about lobbying in Washington. You know, as recently as 2 years ago, they were spending more than $50 million per year on lobbyists. And not just, you know, Joe Schmo, they were hiring former senators like Trent Lott and John Breaux, major movers and shakers in Washington. So the Russians were serious about it. To date, Ukraine has just, you know, lollygagged around the edges and depended on the diaspora. Now, I'm not criticizing the diaspora. The diaspora plays a very important role, and they were instrumental, I would say, in Euromaidan. They're very important, but there's a difference between diaspora and full-time lobbyist. And any country that is serious about advancing their interest in Washington, whether it's lethal weapon sales, you can't rely just on the diplomats or the diaspora. In my opinion, if you're serious and you want things from Washington, you got to pony up for the lobbyist. So that's one thing I would recommend strongly, especially in light of the current changes in Washington, for this administration to do.
Recently, the Prime Minister opened up an investment office in the Cabinet of Ministers. Katie, you're going to be our resident economic expert today. Do you think that the Trump presidency will help build business in Ukraine, or will it pervert business in Ukraine?
Trump's business record is very interesting and questionable, and it's something that came up over and over again in the election. Obviously, wasn't important to the electorate that he evaded taxes and had several businesses go bankrupt as a specific strategy of developing business. So, you know, I think that's not a great example for Ukraine to be looking at as it creates or tries to create new economic policy and searches for investment strategies. But, you know, this is the, on the other side, I think this is a really remarkable example to look at, because to have somebody boast about taking advantage of a financial system that in the end has sort of negatively impacted the country's economy and negatively impacted a lot of the electorate, ironically, the people feeling the squeeze of the economic decline in the U.S. are also the people. It's because of the policies that businessmen like Trump are following and taking advantage of. So it's a lesson to look at and say, we cannot set up financial systems that allow businesses to use bankruptcy as a strategic move to build their businesses. We cannot have policy and investment policies and investment strategies that allow certain types of businesses to come in and completely take advantage of different contexts and different situations.
Well, see, that's, again, an issue you bring up of basically sovereignty, right? American business, Canadian business coming into Ukraine, where's the balance between Ukrainians' business, Ukraine's business interest? And this brings me into this notion of cooperation and something that you're talking about, which is getting to work and proposing perhaps to their American colleagues a way of working together. Do you think the United States maybe will begin to take the MH17 terrorist act seriously and help with that investigation? Ukrainians have provided a lot of the information. Do you think that there will be, maybe that will be the area where they can cooperate on an issue that's of really importance? I mean, it's basically Lockerbie too.
Yeah. Well, United States is one of the so-called grieving nations connected to MH17. So, of course, they've had a lot of input. They've provided legal assistance, forensic experts, that sort of thing. But the investigation itself is really in the hands of the Dutch. It's a Dutch-led investigation, but involving about 20 countries, including Ukraine. And things are on a pretty clear path right now. What will happen next is the Dutch have indicated that they have a heck of a lot of evidence, that they're prepared to name about 100 suspects. Now, there are two key things we'll be looking
at. 100 suspects?
Yes, that's correct. So we're looking at, that was a surprise, by the way, on September 28th when they made public their most recent findings. So there are two things we'll be looking for. Number one is, of course, one assumes that most of the suspects are in the Russian Federation. Can they be located? And number two, will they be extradited for a trial? Now, it's my understanding is Russia does not extradite for foreign trials, so that probably won't happen. And secondly, as I said in a talk in Toronto recently to the Ukrainian American Bar Association, is that there's no kind of legal form to try this, such a big case. So what's being proposed right now is perhaps a Lockerbie-style trial where a special court will be located perhaps in the Netherlands or out in some other jurisdiction to try this, or perhaps a domestic kind of prosecution venue will be created within the Netherlands with very, very strong powers, including powers to ask for extradition. But it's a very long road ahead. I know that many families are very, very eager to see justice done, but there's going to be a lot of patience required for this to happen. But justice needs to be served. 298 innocent souls perished in that crash, and a lot of work has been done, a lot of progress has been made, but it's very important that all these grieving countries provide that kind of political will for justice to be served.
How is that going to impact anything that a Trump administration will want to reset relations with Russia if there's this potential point of disconnect between Putin and Trump?
Yeah, well, that's true. You know, that could be a very, very big source of friction, and maybe the administration may not want to push that. Similarly, the same thing with sanctions. A lot of political will needed there. And, you know, when I was here last time, a little over a month ago for the YES conference, there were French politicians here that started to voice quite a bit of doubt about continuing sanctions. Their feeling was, well, look, you know, our farmers are really hurting because they can't do business with Russia. They can't export their goods there. So I'm starting to get the feeling that there's a weakness among some of the European allies for continuing sanctions. And that would be very, very damaging, I think, for Ukraine.
A lot of that is a quid pro quo, extradite Russian nationals in exchange for reduction in sanctions, or something that would potentially throw a big wrench into the system. Now that there is a Republican in the White House, apparently the Senate is in the hands of the Republicans and the House of Representatives stays in the hands of the Republicans. Do you think, Brian, that it's likely that Ukraine will get lethal weapons, or will that be used as one of these bargaining chips for Russia to come into line?
It obviously would have been a lot more likely under a Hillary Clinton administration than a Donald Trump administration, given Trump's positions with regard to Russia and Ukraine. Now, however, the initiator and the impetus for lethal weapon sales has always been from the Congress. And in fact, in the early days of Euromaidan, when the White House was silent, it was the Congress and various congressmen from John McCain to Tom Cotton and different representatives who were on the forefront leading the charge to support Euromaidan, support Ukraine, and then ultimately support your lethal weapon sales. One of the, say, silver linings in the election for Ukraine, and again, we can only base Trump's victory on the statements he's made about Ukraine, which have not been encouraging. However, one of the upsides of the Republican Senate victory is that four members, three of which were strongly pro Ukrainian, the hawks on lethal weapons, were all reelected. That includes Senator John McCain, who'll be there for the next 6 years, Marco Rubio in Florida, another 6 years, and then, of course, in a surprise, Rob Johnson from Wisconsin, who's also been a good friend and supporter of Ukraine. So, you know, there's always a silver lining.
Hold on, yeah. Sorry to interrupt, but given what Katie's saying, if there's a reset in the Canadian policy and Trump is looking for a similar reset, a la what Michael's talking about, are the Western powers maybe going to collude the way they did when the Suez Canal happened, where there was an exchange for Eastern Europe for the Suez Canal? Do you see this happening, Michael, Brian, Katie?
hard to say. International politics is very dynamic. You know, and as Katie pointed out, you know, we have this free trade agreement with Ukraine, and one of the theme songs, if you will, of Trump over the campaign has been the tearing up of these agreements, because he says that, you know, this is very costly to jobs and so on. But things work very dynamically. And I think, as Brian said earlier, what is said on the campaign trail isn't necessarily implemented when one is in office. A lot will depend on the people he surrounds himself in office. You know, it's going to be very interesting to see who has his ear. And I'm wondering if Paul Manafort will be rehabilitated to be in the White House and one of the wings of the White House, as people know, your listeners well know, that he has had very strong links with the former administration of President Yanukovych. Mm-hmm. Was very well remunerated for that. So whether that will have an influence on things will be something to look out for.
But the global political dynamic is shifting. And ironically, you know, Immigration Canada's website crashed during the election, indicating that a lot of people are looking at how to get to Canada. So there's, you know, Canada's reputation is rising. And so there's an expectation. I think this raises the expectation on the Trudeau government and will raise the expectation on how they react to the Ukraine, especially the war, because we're supporting the war with defense and military.
Well, exactly. The U.S. has been providing training. The Brits have been providing training. The Canadians have been providing training. Do you see those programs expanding now, or do you see them fizzling out, Brian?
I mean, these are really the million-dollar questions, or multi-million-dollar questions in this case. You know, one of the things that Trump said, which actually resonated with, you know, as they say, Joe Sixpack in the U.S., was, you know, the NATO allies need to pay more for the defense. We're paying for their defense, and the Cold War is over. Why are we having to pay? They should pay their fair share. As a rhetorical point, that's a great rhetorical point. On a practical point, there's reasons why that is. And the reasons why, as long as there's NATO, the U.S. is always going to be paying the lion's share of the bills. So if you're thinking along those lines, and we're talking Canadian and British military training or even weapon sales, you know, that might actually be in line with Trump's comments. But I mean, again, you know, what did Trump really mean by that, and what will actually be implemented? It can be two different things.
Right. And on to Trump's comments, this is what I wanted to share with you guys and get your take on some of these comments. I went through and looked. The BBC actually came up with this list of comments that he's made at the CPAC conference back in 2014. He's talking about Putin. He goes in and takes Crimea. He's taken the heart and soul because that's where all the money is. I was surprised. I heard that the other day that they were saying most of the wealth comes right from that area. That's the area with the wealth. So that means the rest of Ukraine will fall, and it's predicted to fall fairly quickly. Michael?
Well, excuse me, let me answer it that way. This way is that for doing business, if you will, with somebody like that is, again, you have to get your influence there. And I think Ukraine has to really, really up its game. What I mean by that is diplomatically, it's really appalling how little resources are actually allocated to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Did you know, for example, that for our, the Ukrainian ambassador in Ottawa to travel to where I live, to British Columbia, he has to turn to the Ukrainian community or find funding elsewhere to actually make that flight. Ukraine had its major diplomatic posts vacant for about a year. We're talking about London, we're talking about Ottawa, Washington, and Canberra. That's just unacceptable in today's world. And then Katie is more of an expert on this than I am, but in terms of trade promotion, you know, I look at my own province of British Columbia, and we're, you know, not an extremely wealthy province, but we have trade promotion offices in places like Taiwan, Hong Kong, and elsewhere. And I've actually suggested this to the Ukrainian government. On the one hand, they love to say Ukraine has talent. Ukraine has a lot of potential, but you have to promote these things. One more quick point. I mean, I just came from Turkey, and there were officials there from the trade promotion office showing us what they're up to. And it's absolutely amazing in terms of the money they spend, in terms of the videos they have. And one of the things they're doing, it's very smart, is getting surrogates to speak on behalf of Turkey. They're getting CEOs of major companies doing business with Turkey, going on camera and saying, Turkey is a great place to do business. Come and join us. Whatever happens in Washington under Trump, it's not going to be an excuse for Ukraine to stop its path of reform, especially the anti-corruption battle. Now, it'd be interesting to see at a high level whether Trump will appoint someone like the vice president. Joe Biden was kind of the point man for Ukraine. He came here. He waved his finger very strongly at the Verkhovna Rada and says, you guys really have to up your game and clean things up. So now I think what may happen, you may see more of Ukraine-Europe access. Ukraine has to look more to Europe for assistance and support, that sort of thing. So even crucially more important that this fight against fight against corruption continue on a very strong path. We're seeing some very worrisome signs right now. Very difficult to sift through the tea leaves and see what happened in Odessa, but the very abrupt departure of Shakashvili is not a good sign in the kind of the international arena.
Again, if they're serious about it, they need to get full-time lobbying help. That's number one.
So you think they should take the dollars that the members of parliament in the Rada talked about and put that toward their foreign policy?
You know, they obviously have enough cash to do it. So
literally,
you know, they have the money, and you know, typically in the past they didn't want to show it and so forth. Well, they're showing it now, at least a fraction of it. And I think the best way that they can make both their diplomatic representation as well as the diaspora all work together in an effective triangle is to have full-time lobbying help in Washington, and especially now with the new administration.
Well, I certainly hope that they get the message that Ukraine starts to put their resources to work. Katie, Michael, Brian, thank you very much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you.
Ukraine's first human rights organization, the Ukrainian Helsinki Group, is celebrating its 40th anniversary. The group was founded in 1976 by Mykola Rudenko, in order to educate people about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that was adopted by the United Nations General Assembly back in 1948, and to monitor the then-Soviet government's compliance with the Helsinki Accords on Human Rights. The Helsinki Accords was the final act of the 1975 Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe that had 10 principles aimed to improve relations between the Communist bloc and the West. This laid the foundation for today's Organization on Security and Cooperation in Europe that continues to monitor Russia's war against Ukraine. Many members of the Ukrainian Helsinki Group were subsequently arrested and sent to various prisons in Russia's Gulag or even exiled from Ukraine. And still, some people in the world believe that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the worst geopolitical moment in history. On November 9th, Ukrainians marked National Language and Literacy Day. The tradition was started by the country's second president, Leonid Kuchma, back in 1997. The day honors Nestor the Chronicler, a monk of Caves Monastery of the Caves, who is considered the author of the primary chronicle, believed to be one of the earliest written documents in an East Slavic language. Many in Ukraine consider that the written Ukrainian language began with Nestor. Today's President Poroshenko marked the day by quoting a famous contemporary Ukrainian poet, Lina Kostenko, quote, "Nations do not die of heart attacks. First, they are deprived of language." Ukrainian content comes into effect this week. Ukrainian music radio stations must play a quarter of songs in Ukrainian during prime time and have at least 50% of their programming in Ukrainian as of this past Tuesday. In the next 2 years, the quota for songs and programming in Ukrainian will gradually be increased to 35% and 65%, respectively. The opponents of this law mainly question whether or not there is a sufficient amount of high-quality music material in the Ukrainian language to fill the quota, and some actually fear that they might lose audiences because of this state regulation. Now, to challenge these views, one of the authors of the law and the head of the Parliamentary Committee on Freedom of Speech and Information Policy, Victoria Sumar, launched a viral campaign on Facebook asking people to post their favorite song in Ukrainian. She shared the song by the Telnyuk sisters and Kozak System called Come Back Alive. And in so doing, she provided an additional political context to the law by alluding to the Russian aggression against Ukraine. As of Wednesday evening, there were almost 40 Facebook posts under the hashtag Sluhaj Ukrainske, or Listen to Ukrainian. A lot of people in politics got on board with the effort, and even President Poroshenko posted a song by Okyan Elze called Veseli Brate Chasy Nastale, or Happy Times Are Ahead of Us, Brother. And even Prime Minister Groysman posted a song called Love Ukraine by the Ukrainian group TIK. We'll include links on our site. This week we have a song by Katerina Nizko-Poklonna. She's originally from Donetsk, but Russia's invasion and war displaced her to Kyiv, where she continues to compose and perform her music. The song is called Tamde, which means there where. Enjoy. We'll continue to watch these and more stories as they unfold. Next week is the lead-up to the third anniversary of the Euromaidan Revolution, and if you have any suggestions or comments, feel free to write the show at ukrainecalling@hromadskyradio.org. I'm Marco Supran in Kyiv. Thanks for listening.